Okay, everyone, welcome to the work session for the Springfield Planning Commission, March 19th, 2019. We'll go ahead and take attendance. The chair is here. Vice chair?
Present.
Commissioner Bowes?
Here.
Commissioner Landon?
Here.
Commissioner Gill?
Here.
And two excused absences, Commissioner Bergen and Commissioner McGinley. Do we have any business from the audience? Hearing none. We have a single work session item, which is an update on the update of the development code, and that is by Senior Planner Mark Rust.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
And Commissioners, glad to be before you again tonight. And I am here to give you an update on the update. So the I gave you kind of the initial presentation and formal update on the project as it began back in September. So I know you've seen me and information on the project quite a bit between then and now, primarily related to the community engagement plan. You were definitely, I presented to council last night, so you're going to, for the most part, hear what the council heard last night, although you've heard a lot more throughout the last handful of months than the council has, because you've been involved, like I said, on the community engagement plan. But the main thing I want to get to and get some input or thoughts or just have you help me go through is this draft code audit memo that was included in your packet. But before we do that, I want to go through a little bit of a PowerPoint here and kind of just give you a status update of where we're at and where we're going. So I'll jump right into that. Oh, I did provide you just a one-page handout tonight. Nothing on this is new information. This is just a summary of information out of the community engagement plan, the project purpose, objective, key messages, and then the timeline on the back. So I just thought instead of having to dig through the community engagement plan, if you want a quick reference, that could be that. So the timeline here, I've put a red line on that shows where we're at. And again, I've been through this with you as a quick reminder. The yellow bars are the housing, the residential phase that we're in now, phase one. The orange bars down in the middle are what we'll be soon getting into, which is the commercial industrial phase of the project. And then the final third phase that's represented by the blue bars is what I call the everything else phase. There'll be a lot of stuff that we'll still be dealing with that doesn't easily fall into the other phases. As I discussed early on and initially, that this is a very, in my mind, a pretty aggressive timeline to do the amount of work we're going to be trying to do. We were working with you and council on trying to figure out how to do this project a little bit differently than some of the other projects that we do that take just as long or that can be fairly involved timeline-wise. So trying to accomplish a pretty sizable amount of work in what I think the 3+ years is going to be a challenge, but I'm up for that challenge. The project team we put together is up for that challenge, so we're gonna do our best. We did add a year onto the end for the implementation phase, so it actually shows 4+ years. The thought is that fourth year we'll be implementing all the new code and figuring out some processes and training staff and all those types of things. I don't need to go read through these again. You have these in front of you on your handouts. The purpose statement as a reminder, the project objectives. We did, as I think you were involved, well, you were involved with the formation of the governance committee. So we held our first governance committee meeting. That was back on March 5th. So two of the commissioners from this group that aren't here tonight, Commissioner McGinley and Commissioner Bergen, are the two governance committee members from this group that are together with two of the city councilors. Councilor Van Gordon and Councilor Moe are the two city councilors that so make up the four-member governance committee. That meeting was pretty much a preliminary introduction for that small group into the project. we'll be using that group, that committee, for a couple different things. One is to have an avenue for public involvement before we get into the more formal public involvement phase of the project and even on into the public hearing process. But as things start developing and coming out, we envision that governance committee as an opportunity for the public to come and make comments, and that we feel will help eliminate potential conflicts of interest and those types of things throughout the process. And then the technical advisory committees, as I said, and I think I've been over this with you, as part of the community engagement plan, the technical advisory committee is a larger umbrella of different subgroups. So we have formed the community technical advisory committee for the housing phase. Very soon we'll be moving into forming a technical advisory committee for the commercial industrial phase. So we'll be starting recruitment for that soon. We'll come back to this body again as the Committee for Citizen Involvement to appoint members to that TAC, like we did for the housing TAC. The other parts of the TAC, as I've discussed before, include the staff portion of the technical advisory committee that we're going to confer with throughout the project to make sure we get different input and other government agencies and utility providers, those types of things. So as part of that timeline, there's the work task list. And I had presented these slides in terms of the work program tasks initially. And I've presented them here again and checked off ones that we've completed or kind of updated the status of some of where we're at. A lot of this is repetitive, or you've seen it before. But like I just mentioned, we have formed the technical advisory committee. I plan to bring these slides back as a checkoff list throughout the process so we can see the progress we're making. This is primarily focused on the first phase of housing as well. We did finish and complete the community engagement plan. And now here on this slide is showing that we have this draft code audit report that's before you tonight. I do want to talk just a minute about the housing TAC that we have. Rick Satry, he's actually on our TAC. He was elected as the chair of the TAC, so I'm glad he's here tonight. He's and the rest of the TAC have been great and quite involved. The first, we've had three TAC meetings now with the housing community TAC and have focused primarily on this initial stage with our consultant that you've heard a little bit about through our Department of Land Conservation and Development through the state. We were awarded some technical assistance to help pay for, or they are paying for, the consultant out of Portland to help us do this initial code audit piece. And that's focused on reviewing our existing code for clear and objective standards for approving housing. And that is a state law requirement that we have a clear and objective tract for approving housing. Our code doesn't meet that requirement today. It's clear that there are many areas that we don't have a clear and objective tract for approving housing. So this draft code audit in front of you tonight is beginning to highlight the bigger areas that we need to work on. Their final report won't be done until the end of June, or maybe it's the beginning of June. And so they'll be diving in a lot deeper and in a lot more detail with that final report that you will see as well. So what's happening now is we're taking this draft report, providing input and feedback. The TAC will do this. You will have an opportunity to provide feedback tonight, and can always send me follow-up emails as well. But if you think there's areas that need to be drilled down more on in terms of the final report from what's presented in this draft report, that would be good feedback for you to give. And then, so that's kind of the initial clear and objective phase. So the consultant is basically, they're not going to attend any more meetings on our behalf. They will be working on producing that final report. So the TAC meetings from here on out with the housing group will be working on different topics for moving forward with developing new draft code concepts. Like I've mentioned, we'll be repeating this process in three different phases. This will move forward through creating the draft development public outreach code, and then take that out to the public for comment and input before we actually do any kind of formal public hearings process. This body, the Planning Commission, will hold the initial public hearings process. When we get to that stage, make a recommendation to the City Council, then we'll hold a completely separate adoption hearing process at the City Council level as well. And then we'll do it all over again. And these, as you've seen in the timeline, will overlap the employment phase of the project and then the other phase, the other code sections phase. This is the list of the housing TAC participants. You've seen this, you approved them. This is just a reminder. As I mentioned, we're quickly going to be doing outreach and recruiting for the Technical Advisory Committee for the commercial industrial phase. So these were the listed up here are the categories and areas that were approved as part of the community engagement plan that you worked on and the City Council worked on. This isn't necessarily one person per category type of list. We did go have some back and forth with the housing TAC list. So if there's input from you on the dynamics of how we do this now that we've been through it once, maybe we've learned some things we want to do different with recruiting and appointing for the commercial industrial TAC list, that is another area of discussion we can have, if there's thoughts you have on that. And then really I'm here to talk about this draft audit. I'll jump to that now and then give you an opportunity we can have the discussion about it tonight. I did just want to, there's a lot in this draft audit report or memo. So I was just going to touch on a couple high points though that I think are areas that the TAC and staff think are some of the bigger areas to work on. The first I'll mention is the multifamily housing standards. It primarily starts on page 5. So there's a lot of discussion in here about those multifamily housing standards, and I think especially with some of the statewide discussion that's going on right now at the legislative level, I'm not sure if all of you have heard about House Bill 2001. It's a piece of legislation that's contemplating requiring allowing duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, other types of multifamily housing in all single-family home zones in any city around the state that's over 10,000 people. There's been some amendments, so that number may actually be different. There's some talk about raising it to 25,000. So anyway, some things are in play. I think there was actually just an article in the paper today about that as well. But the concepts of multifamily in general and having a clear and objective approval path for multifamily housing, we don't have today. These standards have subjectivity in them. You know, we've talked a little bit about what does clear and objective mean, and I think Christina, our assistant city attorney who's on our project team, could give you a better idea of the legal definition, but basically means it can only be interpreted one way. It has to be clear. There's not discretion used in deciding if that criteria is met or not. So that can prove to be a bit of a challenge. And the other part of that is balancing then the need to have that clear and objective standard with the desire to have the code be easy to use. Because just because something's clear and objective doesn't mean it's easy to use or understand. So that's one of those pieces we're going to have to work on and try and get right, find the balance. The second area I wanted to highlight in here, and the report doesn't go into it that much, but it's on page 9, and that's the infrastructure development standards. So the consultant, through working with us, but also working with DLCD themselves and the group of consultants around the state that are helping all of the cities do similar types of work with their own codes, they actually met and discussed this topic of infrastructure development standards, because everybody's a little bit scratching their head on exactly how to get to the point of clear and objective standards for infrastructure. There's a balance between what's required in our development code as an approval standard for, say, a housing project or development, versus what's truly an engineer specification that doesn't have to be in the development code. So we're going to be balancing those ideas and concepts along the way. Some of the way we've talked about it is the difference between what might be viewed as like a two-dimensional standard, something that would be on just a map that you see looking down like from an airplane, versus a three-dimensional standard of like how much base rock is under a road or a sidewalk, so that as soon as you go to that third dimension, that's more of the engineering standard, like how something's built. An example of maybe a two-dimensional is, so how many street lights along a street, are they spaced 30 feet apart, or do we talk about how many lumens they have to illuminate the street with, and they get to decide how far apart the poles are to get to that lumen, or do we regulate the height of the street poles? And anyway, there's a lot of things that come into play. So that's one area that the consultant has indicated, based on those conversations at the state level, that they probably won't be able to provide as much direction on, and so that we'll have to take that on a little bit more. And it, like I said, it references in here the EDSPM. That's our engineering design standards manual for the city, where all those specifications are. And even through the TSP implementation process that you guys have recently heard, some of those EDSPM provisions are being moved from the EDSPM back into the development code to kind of rectify that issue of what's actually an approval criteria or not. And then lastly, the third area I just wanted to highlight, it's another bit of a, it can be a challenging area, and that is for mixed-use development. And there are, we kind of go into that on page 7. The consultants in the memo on page 7 talk about the mixed-use zones. So the questions that come up with a mixed-use development is whether it's vertically mixed, so you might have commercial on a ground floor and residential above, or it might be horizontally mixed, it could be one or two stories or whatever, but there's on the ground floor, there's both commercial and residential. If we're required by state law to have clear and objective standards for the housing piece, it begs the question about, do we have then clear and objective standards for that commercial piece that's in the same mixed-use building or not? And so that, it, the guidance from the state on that is that we do have to have clear and objective standards for the housing piece and mixed use. So figuring out how to make that work with the commercial piece as well might be a little tricky. So that's some of what's highlighted in that regard. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm happy to talk more about any of this or get into more detail or answer questions.
Commissioner Holmes.
I have a number of things listed here, but specifically when you were on page 9 in regard to which documents that various design standards should be in, whether it's the procedures manual or in the code, I know, and you're aware too, that there has been several presentations where there has been standards that have been moved into the code that were previously in the manual. But I don't know that there was any distinction made at that time regarding the two levels of design standards. So I remember that we did look at the design standards for the Glenwood refinement area, but there wasn't any mention of being a partial movement, it was going to be moved en masse. So is this something that has to be revisited then as to what goes where?
Yeah, maybe Christina can chime in on that question.
We did look at that, whether something was appropriate to stay as an engineering standard or whether it was truly a design standard. For the Glenwood piece specifically, they're very clearly all design, two-dimensional design standards that implement the refinement plan policies very explicitly. There's actually a LUBA case involving the city where it was not, they found it wasn't relevant to their decision because the EDSPM wasn't itself appealed, but LUBA actually said that if those EDSPM policies are implementing the refinement plan, then they need to be adopted as land use regulations. So for the Glenwood piece, it's all design regulations that belong with the development code. There's nothing that would move back to the EDSPM. And then with the TSP part that the council hasn't yet adopted, but that you recommended approval on, we did look at what's a design standard versus what's an engineering specification. Essentially, my view is that the guidance we got from DLDC through the consultant matches what we were internally talking about. I don't think we ever articulated it to you as the 2D versus 3D approach, but that's how we've been viewing this for about the last 2 years.
I guess I could ask, how long has this report been out, the consultant's report?
They just issued it. There's a date on it here, February 28th.
Oh, okay, because I wasn't sure the sequence. Okay.
2 or 3 weeks. And again, this is a draft, so they're seeking input, and the final report will be much, it's not a typical, like 90% draft, and they're just going to polish it up and have it be a final report. They characterize this as more maybe a 50% draft, and they're going to do a somewhat substantial more amount of work to prepare the final report.
So some of the conclusions we've modified possibly?
Potentially, yeah, and definitely based on feedback, yes.
Thanks.
Further questions?
Yeah, just a couple clarifying points, things that I wasn't quite understanding. So on page 8, going back to the mixed use portion, it says under specific development standards that there's allowance for 100% residential uses, but it's not possible to achieve given that 60% of ground floor must be used for commercial uses. So where are those two? I'm assuming they're not right next to each other. You know, where do you find those two things separately? Is one in zoning and is another under, like, specifically?
I'd have to pull it up to be exact, and I probably could, but I actually think that is a provision that's pretty almost the same provision.
Oh.
And it's very clear that it contradicts itself. So it's one of those glaring errors, like, how can this be both ways?
Okay.
I mean, it's one of the low-hanging fruit, right? It's like, we need to fix that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's actually the same provision. It's, you know, it references there 3.2-630, so it's all within that same section, whether it's different subsections or not. Mm-hmm. Although it does reference subsection A.1.B, so I think, trying to remember off the top of my head, I think that statement is all in that same provision. So it's not like it's two disconnected pieces.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I'll be looking in the code later at it. I just didn't have time before.
Yeah.
But another one I was curious about, same page on the Hillside Development Overlay District.
Mm-hmm.
It mentions that the geotechnical report requirements in section yada yada could be a concern because they rely on professional engineering judgment to demonstrate that lots are suitable for development and impose minimum variance. So is this saying that asking for a report is not clear, an objective, or that it's a barrier to being able to develop?
Right. And actually, you just mentioned something I did want to mention, and I'll set it aside. But the whole idea of a barrier to development is another idea that I actually meant to touch on separate from clear and objective standards. But I'll come back to that, and I'll answer your question first. So this Hillside Development Overlay is probably one of those things that's going to fall into phase 3 under everything else. There's a lot of natural hazard mitigation work that's been done, and Dog Yammy's studied our city and done more specific mapping for slow and fast moving landslide hazards and stuff like that. So we're going to be eventually trying to incorporate some of that information into new development standards for hillside development. So this probably isn't an issue we're going to deal with right of way necessarily, even though it can and probably is related to housing. So just with that, and Christina may even be able to touch on that because we've talked about, I think, of the TAC. And so the idea is it could be a clear and objective standard if we just say, go do a geotech study and give that to us. Where it ties our hand then at that point is, we just have to take that report and say, yes, that's correct. You did the report, whatever it says. We don't have any discretion to say
that
we don't think you gave us
feedback. Is there anything saying if the report comes back with this information, then you can do A or can't do B?
Well, so whatever that engineer came up with as, say, recommendations for how to mitigate for the hazard, or say they had to, you know, I don't even, like, drill pilings down to bedrock to be able, for the foundation of the building or whatever. If that was what they came up with as the recommendation, then that would be the condition on that approval. But we wouldn't have, I mean, we don't necessarily have that in-house capability anyway for geotechnical type of analysis. And it may just not apply, it may not just apply here with the hillside development standards, other professional kind of studies. It could be the traffic study stuff that comes up more often in development. But is there anything you want to add to that, Christine? Does that sound right?
I think it would, I mean, if the clear and objective requirement is that you provide a stamped, you know, a stamped report from a licensed engineer in the state of Oregon showing X, then there, you know, that we had discussion about, is that really a discretionary requirement or not? The fact that there's discretion being used, it's not the city's discretion, so we think it would meet the clear and objective requirement. But again, there could be some discomfort with that because the city does have professionals in certain areas who may disagree with the way the analysis is done. That does come up from time to time. And so we would be deferring that all to you know, engineers that aren't paid by the city. And while we assume that their engineering ethics would protect that, I think that's a point of tension, I guess.
And there's plenty of situations where you'll have battling experts. You know, say a neighbor didn't want this house to be built or was fearful that was going to slide down onto their house and they hired their own geotech or something. It's still a clear and objective standard. We just say you have to go do it. It doesn't give us the ability to weigh those two different pieces of evidence.
Thank you. That makes sense.
And if I could just loop back around on that idea of barriers to development, because if you've read through there are ideas in here that may not necessarily be clear and objective standard issues, but that we're all, the consultant and we as staff, are also taking ideas that are, we may have a clear and objective standard, but it might be a barrier to development. Mm-hmm. So some of those are also highlighted in this report, mm-hmm. and we're taking input and feedback on both of those kinds of ideas.
Another one?
Sure, go ahead.
So, page 7 at the very top, it's talking about section such and such allows adjustment up to 20% by the director. Mm-hmm. Presumably a type 2 review and requires greater adjustments to comply with type 3 major variance process. So, when it says 20%, does it just mean 20% of any quantitative measure?
Correct.
In general.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. I mean, so this is under the multi-unit design standards variance, which is separate from our very general variance process that we have for the whole code.
Right.
At least I'm just trying to read off the top of my head here to make sure that's right. And maybe this is, because at the last sentence of that, top of page 7 says the general approval criteria for all adjustments in section 3.2 250B. So maybe this could be the general variance criteria. You know, and what this somewhat highlights too is the idea of we can have a clear and objective tract, but we can also have an alternative tract that does use discretion. So some of the fine-tuning of this or balance is figuring out where the bar should be set for the clear and objective track. So we could talk about setbacks or height. So should a height limit for a new apartment building be 35 feet? Should it be 40 feet, 45 feet for clear and objective? And then if they want to go above that, maybe a variance is an option, which kicks them into a discretionary tract. Or maybe there's an alternate discretionary tract that if they want to adjust height and setbacks and other stuff, then it goes into a completely discretionary tract for all of it. So there's dialing in where the standards should be set for the clear and objective tract is one of the big points that's going to come before this group. we're going to be, I envision looking at ranges to bring and present. So we will have heard from the TAC, and then we will have heard from the public, and somebody will want it low, and somebody will want it high, and so it lands somewhere around this number. And so what should it be? And this group will probably come up with a recommendation, and then the city council will ultimately have to decide on where the number lands.
Going off that, if you don't mind, Mike.
Sure.
The exception section in page 2, it seemed that the auditor was expressing that they're concerned if too much weight is placed on the discretion, like we were just talking about. Yeah. He said, for example, allowing 3 different materials for fences or an alternative that equally meets privacy needs is approved by the director provides too much discretion for the director. So it seems that those 3 materials, it's very clear and objective.
Right.
But then because you only limited it to 3 and then went to the director afterward, then you're placing too much discretion on the director. So I'm curious as to what it will play out to be, the decision on what's too much discretion, but what's a reasonable amount of discretion.
Yeah. So, and I think this comment in general is a broader overarching identification of how our code is currently constructed. There's a heavy reliance on this. If you look through to some of their sections of code, there's exceptions everywhere. And it's almost like the exceptions are emphasized more than, and the actual standard gets buried, that even if it is a clear and objective standard. So I'm not sure they're trying to point out a specific example, and the one you used about the 3 different types. And so in conversations at the TAC and with the consultants, it's really being very clear, this is the standard, period. These are the clear and objective standards. And then because, and I'm trying to think about how to explain this, but the whole idea that the entire path of the approval process has to be in a clear and objective path. It's, you're in either one path or the other. The way these exceptions are written, it's almost like, well, this can be clear and objective, but this is going to be an exception, or this one's going to be an exception, but we want to be clear and objective here. Because as soon as any part of a decision uses discretion, the whole decision has to be a discretionary land use decision. So I'm not sure this is answering your question, but so the idea is to have a whole entire path identified that's all clear and objective so they can move through a process without any exceptions needed, with the idea or understanding if they choose any one exception, that's going to kick them into the alternative track. Does that answer your question?
Or? Thank you.
If I could clarify on that,
yeah,
like a little bit more. I think, you know, one option that we could look at is something that would, that's not specified in our code now, but we could kick our, we could kick into a discretionary path just the modification of one standard. But our code is not clear about that or doesn't provide a process for doing that. So it wouldn't be something that we could, like in good faith, do now, where, you know, there's clear and objective standards, but somebody wants to adjust just building height under a discretionary process. We could set it up so that they can get that permission via a discretionary process and not open up everything else to discretion. I think legally would be an option.
And there's even, you know, the council is very interested in flexibility. We've heard that term a lot. So just using height as an example, there may be a way, and I've envisioned some ideas about making a way to say, have the height be a range and have that be built into the clear and objective tract. So you could say you could be 35 feet high if you're at 10-foot setback, and then still clear and objective if you want to go to 40 feet, you're at a 15-foot setback or a step back for the upper higher stories. You know, those can still be clear and objective criteria, but it's a tiered kind of approach rather than as soon as you want to go over this hard and fast limit, you're kicked into discretion.
I think, I'll go ahead and weigh in. I think it was, I attended one of the TAC meetings, and it was really interesting. I think a lot of the folks were talking about trying to get to discuss where that clear and objective standard would. One person said, we'd like to have the full clear and objective, and the other one said, well, if we could get 60% and then, you know, have exceptions at that point. But I think the discussion about the exceptions was that the code is old and it's had to be revised over and over again, and I think that's where a lot of the exceptions have come from, because times have changed and so they've updated it by providing the exceptions. And I think since the methodology talks about it being a complete rather than targeted edits to the existing standards, I think that's been the targeted edits have been happening all along as a rule. So this is trying to get it back to the, as you said, to the standard where there's the code and the exceptions are really non-existent at the present time. But I also did want to weigh in on the, and I know it's not currently coming up, but the hillside development standards. I think although I do trust the engineering community, and I am a graduate of the WSU geology department, I still think that there's an instance where there could be a mistake made, and I'd hate to see the city be completely acceptant of consultants' opinions if, say, a large group of consultants in the hillside development had said you need to go with this type of retaining wall for stability, and then you get one engineer who says, well, you know, actually it can be a lot smaller, that the city couldn't actually step in and say, we want you to look at this again. Because I think at that point, the city would be taking some sort of liability from the engineer if it didn't go with what I would call the standard operating practices of that particular hillside area. Mm-hmm. So,
Christina, did you want to?
Just in terms of the liability, I think, you know, if we went down that path, we would build in ways to protect the city from liability. And then, you know, there's also just governmental immunity for decisions that are policy-based decisions. And so if, you know, if it's the city council's specific policy decision to allow developments based on that, I think that would qualify for some level of immunity to the government. But then also just, you know, there's things we could do through development of indemnification where a property owner has to, you know, also indemnify the city, that if that analysis is faulty and there's property damage that and the city sued, then that property owner becomes responsible to cover that. And so that's something that, you know, that's a way to kind of address that particular concern.
I think you bring up a good point, though. There's standard practice, and so there may be, we may be able to say, get to some clear and objective, what I'll maybe call safe harbors, like, and especially with a hazard situation, it's like, we want to be doubly sure that, you know, what is allowed on a clear objective tract is going to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. So they might be, say, overkill. So then if you don't want to do the overkill, then you go into the discretionary tract. Mm-hmm. And then that's when an engineer could provide, say, we only want to do this, and then we can have the back and forth with them through that process. So right. Again, that's dialing in where that clear and objective standard should be set. And I think you point out for some of these situations where it's a hazard situation or it's more unsure, so your clear and objective standards are going to be a lot higher bar to meet rather than try and let everything go.
Anyway. Right. But it also, I'd like to say that the TAC group does look like an excellent, thoughtful group of people, and I think it's really going to be a valuable thing for the city. Further questions, comments?
Can I ask a simple question? Sure. At some point, do they come out, you know, and this is the website, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, where I was going through this, you know, the last few days, and, you know, it talks about here's the way it was, here's the way it is. It's sort of an online web thing that says here's the way it was, here's what we're proposing.
Yeah.
So that you could just kind of scroll down through it and see the changes in context.
Mm-hmm.
thoughts? Because the problem is, of course, I realize that's an awful lot of work.
Yeah, so I mean, there are, in fact, Rick has provided me a really nice spreadsheet that he's used in his private practice for similar types of doing what you're talking about. And so I think there are ways, not on a an entire document standpoint, like here's the residential old zone and here's the new one, but more on a standard by standard. So here's the old multifamily unit design standard section. Here's the new multi-unit design standard section. And here's how they're different. Here's some of maybe what was carried. So kind of a compare and contrast by on a section by section basis. So I think, yes, I think that will be part of the package that comes forward and allow us to see where we're going from where we've been.
That for me would be hugely helpful.
Yeah, I just don't see it happening on lots of people want to see like a track changes version. Like, give us the old code with track changes and show us what's, well, that's not going to be possible in this situation. But I think a kind of a table format of section by section or some certain standards area that we can compare and contrast will definitely be part of it.
Perfect. Thank you.
One other question. Will there be changes to modernize some of the code regarding solar and maybe also wind generation, and then what was the other one? View sheds. Mm-hmm. I know the city doesn't have a view, view rights now.
What's a view shed?
ask in the Southwest Hills of Eugene. Well, there's a lot of people who know what it is.
And I lived in Bend and worked in Central Oregon for a long time, and people always came, and I worked for the city of Bend, and people would come screaming, there's somebody building a house next to me, and they're blocking my view of the mountains. You know, like that was my
just even trees,
picture window.
Trees
okay.
And
okay.
We had zero view protection in Bend, and we'd say, if you put your money where your mouth is, basically, if you want to keep your mountain
buy
view,
the lot.
Buy the lot, right? But then they'd argue about height, you know, and the peak of the roof and all this stuff. But so I don't envision ever getting to view shed protection. I mean, there's the other place I worked in City of Prineville when I was in the private sector, and we were helping a developer do a new subdivision on the Rimrock. If you've been to Prineville, they really value their Rimrock. Well, Prineville actually has Rimrock view protection standards. And a lot of the wild and scenic stretches of the Deschutes River have view shed protection. From basically being in the river looking up, they don't want you to see anything on the top of the canyon. So there is stuff around the state like that, but whether we will get to that in Springfield, I wouldn't envision that happening as part of this project. I would see that if there's a desire by the policymakers or the community, you know, pushing for something like that, say they want to preserve, you know, the tree line. And some of that's been talked about, I think, with the Thurston Hills a little bit. Glenwood, too, I think it was part of the consideration for some of what happened in Glenwood. But I would see that as a separate process coming forward to really just focus on that issue and be separate from the new code update project. In terms of just, I wanted to touch on the solar, though.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was at the meeting you were at or not, but there was some discussion at our TAC already about the solar setback standards.
Okay, that would be to prevent homes from being shaded.
Right.
Oh, that's correct. Okay.
So there's some desire, one, that's it's a, you know, kind of an idea or concept from the 60s and 70s, and so there's some thought about, is it still relevant? Should we keep it? And if we do keep it, how to modernize it or make it easier to use or implement and stuff like that.
Well, I think the alternative energy generation by houses is a reason to think, you know, carefully before solar. If we're thinking about getting rid of the standard, I think that's something that we need.
You're talking
some
solar
study
on the roof or solar in a field?
I think you can have both. I mean, you could have a solar array in your backyard, or you could have it up on your roof, whatever, you know. I mean, right, if you have sun, do you have a guarantee, and you are generating your own power, do you have any kind of guarantee through zoning that you can continue to generate that power, or can you be shaded?
I referenced my experience in Bend. We had a lot of the similar types of solar setback standards in Bend. And my understanding is when, and similar to how Springfield's are, is they were developed with the idea of passive solar, back when that was a bigger thing than even having solar arrays for electrical on the roofs. And it's very formulaic. It's like a mathematical equation that you plug in some numbers. So that, to me, is an example. It might be clear and objective because it's you plug in some numbers and do this calculation and come out with what the setback and the height's supposed to be of the neighbor or whatever. But it's far from easy to use and user-friendly. So again, it could meet the clear and objective test potentially, but it might not be the easy to use and implement test that I think we're trying to get to. So there may be ways of looking at, maybe we just build in the concept into general setbacks and general height requirements and things like that, so we meet the same desired outcome without having to have a real complicated formula.
Okay.
So I thought this was really useful, actually, because I, you know, trying to dig through the code. and to have something to start with. I know the clear and objective thing is a big challenge, and we're being required to do it, but it's kind of a useful tool to help look into this. And this actually helped me think about not looking at line item changes, at really thinking about this whole change as a concept and approaching this as how are we going to make it really easy for everyone to do what we want them to do and give them a process when they don't want to do that. So it was helpful to get me there because it was hard. I was having a hard time getting away from that, like, okay, here's the code language. How do we adjust this and edit it? And I that's not the right approach, and I knew it wasn't, but this was helpful for me to get thinking in the other direction. So I think it's useful.
Any other questions or comments?
So I will be coming back to you on a quarterly basis at the very least to give you continue to check in. We do have our fourth TAC meeting. We're planning to schedule that for April. I'm meeting with the chair and vice chair of the TAC to go over some agenda topic items this week and then schedule that meeting for April. Those do get posted to our website, and the public's welcome to come and attend and listen, as the chair indicated he has. And so I'll, at the very least, be back to you by June. Actually, I'll be back to you before, because we'll be recruiting for the technical advisory committee for the commercial phase, so that'll be coming up before you as well.
I just thought of one other question. You stated that the consultants probably would no longer meet with the TAC,
right,
but there's still going to be some kind of dialogue back and forth, of course, between the consultants and the TAC committee.
Correct. The idea is that at the next, the April TAC meeting, and they know based on the last TAC meeting that any input they have from here through that next TAC meeting, that we'll be able to feed that input back to the consultant. But at some point, we'll cut it off there in April so they can move forward and finalize the report. So I wouldn't say dialogue necessarily, but opportunity for input from, again, we'll be able to convey some of your input from tonight and also then continue with the TAC meeting. So. Yeah.
Great. No further questions, I guess we're adjourned to 7.
Thank you.
Nice project.
Big on
the 7 actually ought to be really easy.
Chauffeur.
Yeah.
Chauffeur. By the way, I really appreciate
Anytime if you need a ride, you know, or you need a ride home or something like that, I got the truck with it. Good job.
Appreciate it.
Unfortunately,
I've got my dad's been driving around everywhere. So, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. He's a pro at it. This point, he takes this scooter down real fast.
And then make it your job. Get over here and turn this off.